Good morning. Good morning. If you don't throw a fist pump during that last song, I don't know if you can call yourself a Bitcoiner. Let's go. Let's get those fists going. Welcome to episode 52 of the Bitcoin Veteran Spaces. My name is Coleman, and I am your host today, and I am joined by Jacob. I see Bob Van Kirk, Randy, Doc, Pretty Blue Eyes, Bitcoin Alaska in the audience. Get out of here. That's right. The Conference for Bitcoin Alaska has a Twitter handle, so if you haven't followed it yet, go ahead and jump on there and start following us. We're going to have a lot of updates for Bitcoin Alaska on that handle. I see Eomar up here. Bob, I just see you join. Good morning, sir. Good morning. Anything happen? Anything interesting happen overnight, Bob?
Overnight? No, not really. Just everybody's digesting the break of the range. So it's fun to see.
It is. I got a question for you, Bob. I don't know how closely you follow MicroStrategy, but I was hoping to get some clarification for the number 42 everyone keeps referencing with the Q3 report that's coming out tonight. Do you have any idea as to what they're referencing with that?
You know, I have not seen that. So to be honest, no, I can't answer that question. Sorry about that. As you always say, I'm just here getting the gunk out of my eyes, so haven't seen that yet.
Sorry about that. Is everyone, give me a thumbs up if you can hear me. My computer just rebooted for the screen. All right, cool. Excellent. Well, everyone's still filing in and getting their coffee refilled, getting their drinks, getting the gunk out of your eyes. I want to make sure everyone understands the reason we do this every single weekday, Monday through Friday at 10 a.m. Eastern time, and that's to show the world what we can do as Bitcoiners. And what do I mean by that? I mean that we don't need a central authority to tell us what to do and how to allocate funds. We can do it ourselves with this freedom tech, with this decentralized currency that we can trade amongst each other peer-to-peer. And so I'm not sure if y'all watched the Bitcoin Veterans video podcast that had happened last night with Shane and Mike, but they went over in quite a lot of detail what had happened when they had boots on the ground for Operation Gabriel. And it was a really, really awakening episode for myself, just to see everything, getting their firsthand experience. Again, we give you updates on here every day, but hear them talk about it in length. It was a great episode. So we'll be talking about it a little bit today, but I highly recommend going to check it out on YouTube, or you can find the link on our Twitter handle here. But give it a listen. It's about an hour and a half, but it's really insightful, and it gives you kind of a firsthand experience of what everyone's going through and their experiences with seeing these people. Good morning, Eomar. I think I talked over you there for a little bit.
I was just going to say that number 42 is the answer to the question of everything in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. So I don't know if that's I don't know if people are just messing around with the 42 thing, but that's the only thing that comes to mind whenever I hear the number 42.
And that was what the sailor quoted, right? He said to get the answer to everything in the Q3, so that's why they're referencing 42 then?
Yeah, probably. I don't know. I didn't see the reference, but whenever if he said the answer to everything is 42, then that's a reference to the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Okay, perfect. So yeah, for those who don't know, MicroStrategy will be giving their Q3 update today after trading hours. So it should be a good one to listen to. I see we have Greg Foss in the audience. Good morning, sir. If you're available, we'd love to have you up here. I love getting your insight on everything, the way the market's going, and then your thoughts on Bitcoin crossing 100,000 in Canadian dollars. And so I'd like to get your thoughts. AC, you haven't been up here in a while. Good morning, sir. Good morning. How are you doing?
Hey, good morning, guys.
Do you have any further insight, AC, as to the cryptic messages that Sailor is releasing for his Q3 update?
Sorry, I just jumped on, so I didn't catch the beginning conversation, but definitely looking forward to the earnings report after market close today, so we'll see what he was alluding to.
Yeah, so let's go ahead and let's start jumping into the show. Some of the big things I want to talk about really quick is BlackRock has been on an absolute tear over the last 2 weeks acquiring Bitcoin. They now hold over 417,000 Bitcoin in their ETF. And yesterday they acquired 8,820 Bitcoin. So just a phenomenal number. It's just, they're getting ready for this run with Bitcoin. And it's pretty crazy to see all of this supply just getting gobbled up and nobody's talking about it. The price is at 72K right now, and there's really nobody talking about anything. So we're still really early. I don't think that we're going to go down in price. I think we're going to really start kicking this bull run off. So if you all want to start kind of talking about that, perhaps, I'd love to get everyone's thoughts. Nobody wants to talk about the ETFs or the price action. The silence from...
I have leaf blowers right outside my window, so...
You're good. Well, let's see. I bet you if I say... let's see. Who can we summon? I bet you we summon Joe Carlisle, so we could say debt spiral. I'm pretty sure we just called Joe Carlisle, so he'll come up here and he'll give us some insight as to what's going on. I think it's really, again, I haven't been a full 4 years through a Bitcoin cycle, so the price getting up there and going through all times highs is really fun for me to talk about and see. But I do think that the amount of Bitcoin that's just getting acquired by these ETFs, and I imagine Saylor is going to leak something tonight with his MicroStrategy Q3 report, that we're going to hit a point where there's just going to be extreme price discovery. And this thing is just going to go parabolic. Just give me 1 second.
Yeah, Coleman. I mean, anytime there's more buyers than sellers, we'll get price appreciation, right?
Yes. But just so I guess for myself, it's just the amount of Bitcoin that's getting acquired daily by these ETFs is just is astonishing for me. Did you see the release that Florida's chief financial officer Jimmy Patronis released yesterday, where they'd like to have the state of Florida acquire a strategic Bitcoin reserve, urging state pensions to add Bitcoin as a hedge against market volatility?
I did, and I think one of the maybe notable things about his letter, if you read it, is that it was a little bit easier for him to write that, considering that the state of Michigan and the state of Wisconsin pension funds have already done this, right? So it's, they're looking to be maybe innovative, but really they're fast followers of some other states that are doing it.
Yeah, so they do, like Bob just said, they do reference Michigan and Wisconsin investing. So Wisconsin invested approximately about $164 million in Bitcoin spot ETFs, and Michigan allocated just a percentage, and I didn't get that number, so I do apologize. So it gets easier as you continue to move on, right? You're not the first one to do it, so you're not really breaking ground, but I think it's really interesting. Florida has a huge economy. I think that if they're their own country, they'd be like a top 15 economy in the world, and so there's a lot of money there, and so it'll be interesting to see if this gains traction and goes through, because he does ask for the SBA to release a report by March of next year to assess the risk and the benefits and the feasibility of adding Bitcoin to Florida's state pension fund. So I think it'll be really good. The timing on it is really good, again, with the price going. So it should be, it'll be really interesting to see how that report comes out. Does anybody else have any thoughts on that? I guess the only concerning thing is that he doesn't necessarily specify Bitcoin a whole lot in the report. He does references the pilot program as a digital currency investment program. So definitely need some work on clearing up their language and understand the difference between crypto and Bitcoin. But overall, I think it'll be pretty good and a plus for.
I hear Tether's only $1 a piece. It's a pretty good, could be a good investment.
I think it's notable that the only cryptocurrency that he actually mentions though is Bitcoin. So I think that I think for a lot of normies, like it's kind of used interchangeably. So I wouldn't be too concerned. I don't see them, buying Cardano or anything like that. I think the focus of this is Bitcoin. They just use like cryptocurrency as like the catch-all terminology, so that like more people understand what they're talking about, I think.
Yes, but I think as a community, we need to really stress it is Bitcoin and not crypto. That's just for myself, it's just kind of, it's a frustrating thing when I hear it getting lumped into that. It's kind of like when people lump yourself and I, Yomar, into the Navy. Yeah, we're part of the Navy, but we're the men's department. It's just a joke for everybody out there. But no, I'm definitely, again, we just want to make sure that we're clear that Bitcoin is its own. And it's not part of Bitcoin. Or sorry, Bitcoin is itself, it's not part of crypto.
Yeah, I agree. But I think it's positive news that more states are getting on board with that. Because those pension funds are massive, you know. So even this writer acknowledges, hey, there are a couple states already doing it. So like eventually it'll get to the point where you don't want to be the one state not doing it, right? And left behind, because then you'll be attacked by like all those pension holders and that's like all your PBAs and all those unions and stuff, and they're huge blocks in elections and stuff like that. So they want to make sure that they're properly handling those funds.
Yeah, and Yomar, I do think that just kind of on those lines, it's one of those things where all these retail people that we don't see in the market, they're not going to drive the price directly right now, but all these people that we're worried about will have exposure to Bitcoin in some way. So that's a good thing.
Yeah. And that goes back to like yesterday, we were talking about like regulatory actions and stuff like that. I think it kind of insulates a little bit, you know, at least from like the punitive regulatory actions. It'll insulate Bitcoin. The more institutions, again, nobody cares about, you know, me or you, but as the institutions and stuff, hold Bitcoin and have an interest in it continuing unimpeded, the state will magically have an interest in doing the same to keep their donors happy. So, I think that's a good thing.
What other states have Bitcoin rights? Does anyone know off the top of their head? Because I know Pennsylvania just tried passing that. It still has to get through their state Senate. But I know Texas had one that got approved, but it has not been passed yet. Wyoming has one, and then Oklahoma got passed. But outside of those, is there anything else that has rights for Bitcoin for its?
So I just Googled. It says that there's similar moves in Arkansas, Louisiana, Montana, and Oklahoma. Each have enacted laws on the rights of crypto users. I don't know the extent or scope of those laws, but it was referencing like the Pennsylvania law, and they said that, you know, those states have similar things.
So I think you hit, I forget what it's called. It's not critical mass, but it's when you get about 10% of any one segment involved in something, the other 90% almost fall in line instantly. And so I think if you get just maybe another two or three states, you're going to see everyone else just fall in line on this. And I see we have Dombe up here. So I'd love to pick Dombe's brain about this. So Dombe, if you missed the beginning part of the conversation, we're talking about Florida trying to get their state pension funds to add Bitcoin onto its balance sheet.
Yeah, I saw that. Very cool. What's his name? Patronus. I was like, dang, this guy's named after a spell from Harry Potter. I'm not sure his name, but... very good.
It is Patronus.
Very cool name. Very cool name. Yeah, I mean, Florida State pensions, I think, are funded around the 80% mark, so not terrible, but they definitely have some room to strengthen. Another couple interesting things about Florida State pension system is they're in talks of divesting heavily from private equity. I think $4 billion they're looking to divest soon out of private equity because, as many people realize, private equity has, you know, it's not the private equity of old. And a lot of the pension systems have over allocated to private equity and are overexposed to private equity. So there's some opportunity there. There's also a lot of pressure to divest from China and holdings in China, which was from Governor DeSantis. So very interesting timing on this report. You know, I know traditionally, I see Foss in the audience too. I think he would back this up. Pension fund managers don't like to be told what to do by elected officials and state folks. And so that's always a unique dynamic, that approach. I've always found working with the board of trustees and the investment team is more effective, right? Because they want it to be their idea versus being told by an entity, you're going to invest in this. They naturally have a resistance to that. So I'd be interested to see, you know, how the reaction is on, you know, some report, but I think it's good. It's good either way. It's kind of going to push the issue, and depending on the CFO's I think it's the CFO Patronus, right? Or what is he, the state treasurer?
No, he's the CFO.
Oh, CFO. Yeah. I mean, it'll be interesting to see what his relationship is with the state pension, but lots of opportunity to check a lot of boxes, right? And if they message it well to the stakeholders, they can identify some of these things by saying, hey, we made a small allocation to Bitcoin to get off zero. We're developing a strategy to potentially identify targets where we may divest out of our holdings in China, which again comes from pressure from, you know, all the stakeholders that want this to happen. Also, you know, private equity, we need to pivot out. Here's a great opportunity to start our journey in Bitcoin, add stability to the pension. And yeah, I hope it goes well for them.
So really quick, Dombey, you mentioned that Florida is about 80% funded. For those who are listening who don't understand what that means, can you go over what that is and some of the states that you've informed us that are quite a bit lower than that 80% threshold?
Yeah. And I think, you know, forgive me, they're around 80. So it's either like 77, it might be a little bit lower. Sometimes the actuarials are a couple years late. They take a while for the pension that size. But the percentage funded for those in the crowd, it just means that the assets on hand, the total value of their portfolio is 80% of the overall liabilities that they currently hold, meaning all the people who are currently receiving retirement or working for the state that are promised a retirement. So the industry standard traditionally has been under 80% is considered unhealthy. You start getting to under 40%, and they say that, you know, a pension can never recover without being intentionally bailed out by some entity, whether it's the state or the Fed. So that's what that means. And again, just for people something to understand, state and local pensions prior to the financial crisis of, you know, 08 were funded in the low 90s on average. So they were much better funded. And then after the financial crisis, many of them dropped to below 80 on average, right, for the whole country, state and local pensions. And again, I talk about this all the time. You would think after the longest equity run in the history of equities that ground would be covered, right, made back, that the funds on average, you would hope to see state and local funds funded. But it didn't happen. And that's because pensions are not inherently built to take risk and gain ground and catch up losses. In fact, not only are they, you know, much more conservative in their approach, but they're not conservative when it comes to growing liabilities, having to keep up with inflation with raises, adding more employees, right? Politicians will sign the bill that, you know, boosts the state workforce, gives them raises, et cetera. And oftentimes, you know, again, you have this pension portfolio that cannot keep up with the liabilities, hence why we push so hard for them to look into Bitcoin, one of the few things that traditionally has shown that it can keep up with liabilities and even exceed the performance needed with just a small allocation.
Do you know off the top of your head the pension funds that you're working with that have allocated into Bitcoin, how much of their ROA has increased?
You know, like the only pension fund that we really talked to that had that actually followed through was on the Nakamoto Gauntlet, which FOSS was a part of, when we talked to the Board of Trustees. Again, these pension funds are hit up by many different angles, right? So there's no one person that can claim. If anyone tells you, you know, I'm responsible for making this pension fund buy Bitcoin, call baloney on that, because there are, look, BlackRock has people talking to people about pension funds. There's governing boards or advisory boards on states that are talking to investment, you know, the investment team. There's elected politicians writing letters. There's stakeholders that are, you know, petitioning to do things. There's knuckleheads like me and nonprofits that are trying to get pensions to add Bitcoin to the balance sheet. So, you know, as to like Wisconsin is the, you know, lone standout, with Michigan making another small allocation. There are lots of conversations that occur, and, you know, what we see melting away is the career risk, and but it's still there. There still are a handful of pension fund managers that feel that if they allocate to Bitcoin, that they will receive tremendous pushback from the stakeholders. And I know that didn't answer the question as far as allocation, but that's because there's not a very wide field of folks that have that data on file.
Hey, Dom, on the other side of that, you know, I don't think it was negative what you said, but, you know, we're coming to the end of the third quarter, and where we get a lot of this data is from the 13F filings that are required to be filed 45 days after each quarter by the managers of these pension funds. And so that's where we get the news that more have allocated to Bitcoin, or the existing ones have, you know, taken a bigger position in the last quarter. So I think we'll see that, right? Well, I'm guessing we'll see that in the next 47 days. We'll see more 13F. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I would not be surprised at all if Michigan took a deeper step. I mean, their approach was obviously a get off zero, you know, like put your feelers out and see, you know, who comes blasting through the door asking for heads to roll. And I don't think there has been much negative response. You add that with the fact that Wisconsin's holding is going to, you know, if we continue to go on a nice little bull run here, that word is going to travel fast, where, you know, they had a very conservative allocation that, I don't know, depending on how they have their rebalancing parameters on the Bitcoin that they're holding and whether they're selling as it goes up, they're going to have a sizable gain for a very minimal, you know, allocation, but meaningful. So yeah, I think Michigan we could definitely see in the 13F that Michigan added to their position, with a handful of other pensions that, you know, are starting to catch up. Again, that's a slow moving ship. So I would not surprise me to see more pensions coming out with actions similar to Michigan, small actions that are very clearly less than 1%, even 0.1% of their portfolio, just to test the waters and get something on the books.
Yeah, and these pension funds tend to leg in, right? They're not smash buying all the time. They're just taking the advice of their, you know, the BlackRocks and whoever they're working with. And so I think, you know, Wisconsin's approach has been, so far, we've only seen a couple of quarters of it, but they've been continuing to accumulate. So I'd be surprised to see them rebalancing and taking profits. They look at these investments probably on a longer term than we would individually. And so it would make sense that Michigan would, and anybody else who's, you know, coming in, like you said, probably will be small at first, but will be legging in and going in at this over several quarters. And I think you're right. The results will speak volumes. And so the people who are slow, they'll get pressure from, again, politicians, you know, other stakeholders, and obviously people who stand to benefit from, you know, participating in these pensions.
Yeah, for sure. You know, as pensions start to get off zero and they don't receive the negative blowback and being attacked, et cetera, you know, again, the conversation will slowly shift to, like, can we get some solid reasons why we're not looking at this, at least just looking at it? And those discussions have to be had. I know they're being had around the country, and they will increase, especially with a strong performing asset, you know, in a bull run. And again, these pensions are not, it's not like Michigan took a step and then half their investment team were fired, you know? And that's the result of 10 years of negative media coverage. And, you know, just having all that negative coverage swirling around is the investment teams mistakenly believe that if they get off zero, that they have career risk, when in reality, they will find that they have strong support from a stakeholder group who, you know, data shows a third of them are holding Bitcoin probably already in some fashion, not to mention the other stakeholders, even the politicians, and, you know, that career risk won't be there if they do it right and they send the right messaging and just say, hey, we're looking into this. They're going to be 100% fine. On the flip side of that coin, 10 years from now, investment team managers that do nothing and don't even look at it, and they don't even have an analysis on the books of how Bitcoin could positively impact the pension, they actually will be the ones that are going to be in a little bit of trouble if they're still around, with people asking, guys, like, we missed this, similar to how CalPERS missed, you know, what they would say the golden era of private equity. And, you know, they're going to be underfunded, struggling, talking about their members working later into their careers, paying more into their pensions as a percentage of total, you know, payment into the pension. And they're not going to be looked back on with a lot of, you know, mercy. So that's why, you know, one of the things me and Foss talked about on the show is, like, get something on the books, go on the, you know, like, whether it's a show to talk about Bitcoin, whether it's doing a pro forma, have something at least to show in 10 years. Oh yeah, well, we overlooked this, but at least we looked into it.
Thank you for that, Dombe. Does anyone else have any questions about the state pension funds or just pension funds in general? Okay, so we'll go ahead and start moving on to the next thing. But while I still have your attention, I just want to give a quick thank you to our partners. First of all, Punch Plate. If you guys have a seed phrase, make sure you stamp it on a metal plate. Go check them out at punchplate.com. Paladin Tower Tactics, professional firearms training at paladintowertactics.com. Black Sheep Ammo, resupply your ammo supplies at blacksheepammo.com. And Solo Satoshi, open source Bitcoin mining at solosatoshi.com. And I just saw we had Lisa up here on the panel, but I just want to give her a shout out. She's the first confirmed speaker at Bitcoin Alaska. So if you all aren't aware, we are going to have a conference in Juneau, Alaska next year, July 5th and 6th. I already threw a link up in the nest for the event and for the Twitter page. Go out there and follow that. And I highly recommend getting a hotel and tickets to this. It's going to be amazing. Wade's been telling us a lot of the events that he plans on doing for everybody going to the conference. It sounds amazing. Alaska in the summer is just gorgeous. Don't be scared just to buy a one-way ticket, because I think once you make it up there, it's going to be really tough to leave. And one of the big things about this event is it is going to be catered to children and family. So there will be a lot of outside events taking place outside of the Bitcoin conference. So go check them out on the link up top or bitcoinalaska.org. Dombey, I see you have your hand up, sir.
Yeah, did Wade take my advice and secure the filming setup to film the new show up there called Bear Hunter, starring Wade and Joe Carlisari? I kind of like, it was a mix off the movie The Edge with Hopkins and Baldwin. You know, we're gonna kill the bear, and then Joe Carlisari maybe is the Baldwin guy who's like, we can't, you know, Carlisari's killed a bear. Maybe Wade isn't. I'll figure that out, but.
I think there is talks of that going on in the back channel, but I think we're pulling short straws to see who has to actually wrestle the bear. So if you're going to Alaska, definitely recommend bringing someone that's a little bit slower than you. So if you do encounter this bear, you don't have to outrun the bear. You just have to outrun your buddy. So I see we have Wade up here now. Good morning, Wade.
Good morning. I'm still trying to secure the cocaine because I want to do kind of a crossover movie. So if anybody has any, let me know.
Probably want to do a private message with that.
Yeah, that's like the movie Insomnia with Al Pacino and Robin Williams. I think you're going down that road, Wade.
But in all seriousness, I can't tell you how excited I am for this conference. It's going to be amazing. There's going to be... A private cruise going up to one of the fjords. So it'll be one of the only conferences, like Wade's saying, where if you buy the whale pass, you're literally going to get a chance to go see real whales. So it's going to be amazing. Wade, I don't know if you want to cover anything else that I might have missed.
Let's see. At baseball, I spoke with a friend of mine who is part of the One People Canoe Society. He's going to have the canoe set up across the street for people who have family members who don't want to attend the conference. So one of our focuses is to make sure that they're entertained and have things to do. So he's going to have his, I think it's a 15-man canoe, 26 foot long, out there in the channel. And they're going to be kids and family members can jump on board. It's going to require an adult, of course, a waiver, but just going to paddle around in the channel. Just things to keep them occupied and having fun. Get out on the water, on the ocean.
Go do some fishing, some hiking. There'll be great camping spots. So again, make a family trip out of this. It's going to be amazing. Again, the conference is 5th and 6th. Get there early, stay late. It's going to be a great time. I actually plan on taking the whole month of July to go spend some time in Alaska. So it's going to be great. I'm really looking forward to it. So moving on to the next topic I want to hit on. And then Jacob, just give me a thumbs up when you're ready to roll with the video. But Ron Paul was talking about, again, Elon Musk with his plan to cut $2 trillion out of government spending, and they kind of had a little back and forth going on X. So we'll go ahead and roll the video and we'll kind of dissect everything and talk about the significance of it.
But there was this fella called Elon Musk. He thought that maybe we could cut some money, and he knows about a lot of money. So maybe a trillion here, a trillion there isn't that much.
Yeah.
So, but is it true that he was giving a speech, and in public?
Yeah.
He said something about cutting.
Yeah.
$2 trillion.
Well, let's take a look at.
Was he drinking?
I don't know what he was up to. But why don't we listen now? He was at a Trump rally, and you might want to grab your earpiece and listen, because he was at a Trump rally recently, and he was talking about cutting the budget, something you don't hear very often. Let's listen in.
How much do you think we can rip out of this wasted $6.5 trillion Harris-Biden budget?
Well, I think we can do at least $2
trillion. Yeah!
Yes.
$2
trillion. I mean, at the end of the day, you're being taxed. You're being taxed. All government spending is taxation. So whether it's direct taxation or all government spending, it's either becomes inflation or it's direct taxation. Your money is being wasted, and the Department of Government Efficiency is going to fix that.
I've mentioned that quite a few times, and I think that's so important that when you spend, it's a tax.
Yeah.
Because one way or another, they're either going to have an income tax or some other type of tax, or they're going to print money, and then it's a tax, it's an inflation tax. And the one other thing that you can depend on is it's not the rich that will end up paying those $2 trillion. It's going to be the middle class. But what impresses me is... he said that in public,
yeah.
You know, and he didn't get hauled off the stage. Yeah. I guess there were a few people who would like to do that, but.
Yeah, and also, you know, the trick that they do on the Hill is they reduce the level of increase and call it a cut.
Right.
It's not a cut.
Fudge
it. Yeah, I mean, inflation as a tax, that's great. Well, you were impressed by what he said yesterday, and you went on to Twitter. Let's show this tweet that you put out when you listened to Elon talk about cutting money. You said Elon cutting $2 trillion from the budget, great idea. Start with some of the biggest welfare recipients, military industrial complex, pharmaceutical industrial complex, and end the Fed. And to our surprise, Elon answered, do the next one. And I liked his response. He said, needs to be done. You can see it right there under the photo. That was a response to your suggestion.
But I have a question. Did anybody read this? Did anybody pay any attention?
Only about 1 million people saw it.
Oh, thank goodness for Trump and Musk. Yeah.
So, very interesting exchange going on with that. Ron Paul goes on later and invites Elon to have him on his podcast that he does, and it's the Liberty Report, that discuss what Elon has planned.
I just love how genuinely excited Ron Paul gets with the thought of slashing government. Like, if you're not a Ron Paul fan, there's something going wrong. I mean, I am generally and almost entirely against fanboying over any politician, but I think Ron Paul transcends like the typical politician. You know, he's stayed true to the things he believes in and has always been an advocate for the United States and for freedom. So, you know, Ron Paul consistently has good takes. And it's good to see that, like, I'm genuinely excited about, you know, Elon Musk, like seeing his stuff and responding and tweeting for it, because, you know, we know Elon's pretty close to the Trump government. And if Elon is listening to Ron Paul, then eventually some of the Ron Paul stuff will trickle into Trump. And, you know, that's definitely good for America, you know, assuming Trump gets elected. So, yeah, anything that advances the Ron Paul revolution to me is a good thing. So,
yeah. So, again, Ron Paul spent his entire career campaigning on this, ending the Fed. He wrote books about it. But my biggest takeaway is that it's gaining traction. It's not just one-liner that they're using and then it just gets buried in the media. Like, it's encouraging for me to see that this is just a continuing an ongoing conversation that they're having. And again, if they had 1 million people that have already seen just that exchange on Twitter, it's people that are waking up. It's people that are getting exposed. So remember the first time you kind of got your awakening experience, you start going down the rabbit hole. Like, it takes time. You can't just go from 0 to 100 instantly. There's a little bit of a journey with that. So that's what gets me really excited. It's just that more people are starting to get the veil lifted and they're seeing really what's going on. And so I hope Elon does go on the Liberty Report podcast. And again, he has a huge following. A lot of people listen. So there'll be a lot of time people are just hearing about Ron Paul or hearing about the Liberty Report, and it'll expose a lot. So
I really think that Trump is doing as good as he can at building a coalition, right? So if you're a libertarian-minded person who's been paying attention for any time, to bring in these folks who a lot of times will stay at home or vote the libertarian candidate, if Trump can win a number of them, over. I think it's really, really good for his likelihood of being president again.
And you're absolutely right, Bob. And I'm not sure if you saw that interview RFK did with Tulsi just a couple of days ago. And I didn't grab the video, so I apologize. But RFK went in that what happened last time during Trump's presidency is that they had the lobbyists come in and dictate his team. And so there's a lot of strings that came attached with that. But what he's doing differently this one, what RFK alluded to, was that he's paying everything out of pocket right now. And so he's getting his transition team going right now. And so they're not having outside influence. So that's encouraging to me because they're not going to have the thumb of the swamp or anybody that's that their tentacles are not going to be so intertwined in this campaign again, in his presidency, if he is elected. And I think he has a lot of strong people that are going to be in his cabinet and his administration. And so I think it's really hopeful that they'll make some really significant changes. The only thing that I would kind of balk at, or I don't think they'll be able to do, is the military-industrial complex. I don't think that's going to be an easy beast to slay. I think it'll be really tough to remove funding from them and kind of get them out. But the pharmaceutical industry with the food and the drugs, I think that's going to be one beast that does get slayed during this administration. And I think RFK is going to make it his mission to do it.
Yeah, and to your point, I don't know about other groups, but the AIPAC and the Zionist interest groups, they definitely have access to Trump. Miriam Adels had given like $100 million and stuff. So, that's one of the sides of the military industrial complex. So they are, the war machine and its appendages definitely have at least some of his ear. My take on his foreign policy is he wants to end the war in Ukraine because he wants to fund a war in Iran. I'm hoping I'm wrong. I'm hoping that, he actually stands by his no new war stuff. But from the foreign policy standpoint, I think that that appendage over there, Israel, is trying to get a war started before Trump gets into office so that it's just something he inherits and has to deal with versus something he can try to stop before it starts. That's my biggest bone to pick with Trump is the inconsistency on the war front. On the domestic front, I think there's a lot of good stuff that's being said and done. And, if we do abolish the income tax, all the war appendage will kind of die off. It's like cutting the lifeblood out of it. So it'll kind of dry it up. So, there's that good long-term prognosis, I guess.
Absolutely. I think if we start taking out some of these other beasts, the other ones just kind of start to wither away. I'm not saying they won't put up a fight, but I do think it'll make it easier to tackle them. And again, have realistic expectations. Even if he has the best cabinet, the best administration, it's really tough to get stuff done in 4 years in one administration. So this is going to be over, I would think, 8 to 12 years, as long as everybody follows through with it. So just have realistic expectations going in. But I do think that it can make some meaningful impacts with everything. And to hit on what you had said, Iyomar, I think it was Thomas Massey said that they do have Israeli handlers with every politician that just kind of puts things in their ear and kind of tells them the way to vote and what to do. So I think that's a serious thing that we need to try and tackle. And Israel trying to start a fight, it was on my notes. We'll just roll right into this. Israel moves to ban UN agencies in Gaza, so raising alarms about the implications. So the agency known as UNRWA provides essential services to millions of Palestinians across the Middle East and has underpinned aid efforts in Gaza throughout the Israeli-Hamas war. Israel has passed legislation with an overwhelming majority on Monday, saying that this organization has allowed itself to be infiltrated by Hamas, and the militants are siphoning aid and using the agency's money and facilities as shields. So I think that's definitely something we need to hit on. And Iyomar, this is more in your wheelhouse, so I'll let you take over if you want to right now. But I do think this is a significant, you can call it an escalation in the war, where they're not allowing the UN to come in and provide aid to people.
I mean, they've been not allowing much of anything in for a while, you know. Even before 10/7, there was, you know, Gaza was essentially in a blockade. You know, that was the policy, was to blockade and, you know, make it into a open air prison camp, is the way it was described by a lot of aid agencies. But they did, you know, previously allow aid in, restricted aid, but aid, you know. Then that, you know, they significantly drive. I forget that there was like hundreds of trucks went down to like tens of trucks, and I think now the north is getting like nothing. So like it's a continuation. Like the UN is a really big thorn on their side, because the United States has spent, you know, decades propping the UN up as like the epitome of global law and order, and we've used it as a tool to legitimize many of our actions. And the problem is that, you know, regardless of your political stance, Israel is acting as a rogue state, in regards to international law and international norms. And the UN is in the way of that, you know. So there have been multiple attempts. There was a case earlier on, I forget when, but within the past few months, maybe it was over the summer. But they basically said, oh, like these UN workers are, Hamas linked, blah, blah, blah. They like suspended these people or fired them or whatever. And then they did an investigation. It turns out there was no substance to it. It was just made up. And it was because they're trying to build this case against the UN, or UNRWA, and specifically to get them out because they're in the way. You know, with, unfortunately, like the way we, behave is like, if, you know, we've become overly accustomed to seeing, you know, other people getting blown up by our bombs and stuff, and we see it as like the casualties of war. But when we see, you know, if we see there's like huge outrage when there's like the World Kitchen employees got killed, there's more outrage when we see, you know, UN workers get killed. That's the stuff we've been trained to be upset about, right? Versus, you know, if we see like, you know, Palestinians and stuff die, that's just what we've been trained to kind of, you know, sorry, it's the cost of war. So that's why I think they're trying to get rid of the UN, because it's an obstacle for them in multiple ways. It's helping Palestinians survive, which if you follow them, like the Israeli cabinet closely, you can see like they don't want that. They openly say that they want to cleanse, like ethnically cleanse, or, you know, just eradicate the Palestinians in Gaza, because a lot of them want like their greater Israel project. So, you know, helping Palestinians live is directly working against what they want. So that's why they're going after the UN. And they even go against the peacekeepers in Lebanon. There have been multiple instances of them firing upon the peacekeepers in Lebanon. And those are like European peacekeepers in southern Lebanon that they've fired upon. So, I mean, it's a rogue state. Like because of the influence they have on our government, we won't label them as such. But if you look at the way the UN has been voting, like the nations in the UN have been voting, there's not much debate in terms of that. Even like some of the European countries are kind of starting to turn. Several of them have like suspended their arms agreements with them and stuff like that. So the longer we keep giving this blank check, and the reason I turn it back to us is because, like, as an American who is raising my kids here, like, that's my main priority, right, is making sure that we have, like, the best country we can have. There's tons of costs going into this. It's really – we talked about, like, BRICS and BRICS looking for, like, an alternative currency and stuff like that. And we mentioned, like, how the like, our founding documents and principles were key in us getting into that spot of global hegemony. We're destroying it by supporting like this, what's going on. You know, our legitimacy and our human rights record that we try to build everything on is just getting completely destroyed. And there's nothing to gain for it. And even if you're Israeli or you're pro Israel or whatever, this is extremely dangerous for Israel, because they can't fight a war on all these fronts. We don't have the manufacturing capacity to enable them to fight these wars. So even if the United States, first off, I don't think there's the will for the United States to put like boots on the ground to save them. And second off, we don't have the manufacturing capacity to flood them with the supplies that they would need to fight these different wars.
I don't know. I'm going to push back right there just really quick. I don't know if there's not a will in the United States. I think surprisingly there is a large will for the leaders to push for boots on the ground and help Israel. And again, I think it just comes into how intertwined they are in our political system.
From the political class, yes, but I mean, yes. From the people. Let me be more specific. Our politicians will do whatever their masters tell them to do because they're paid a lot of money. And it's not just AIPAC. Like AIPAC and the ones that are like explicitly labeled like pro-Zionist groups, that's a fraction of the money. I got onto this talking about the military-industrial complex. It's important to know, like, it's not even like the military-industrial complex isn't just like AIPAC, which is essentially like a pro-war lobby, at least at this point. And then you have like the Lockheeds and the Boeings and all that stuff. But you also have to acknowledge like who owns them, right? All those institutional investors. So that's why you see like Uniform pushing for war, like across media. You see colleges trying to shut this stuff down. You see, like the banks and stuff, like when there was like protests, a lot of like the leadership in some of these organizations were like saying, you should never get a job and all that sort of stuff. There's pushback because they all own interests in the military industrial complex. So it's, when you see like donors from banking or from media or something like that, it's all so intertwined. They all have a hand in the war bucket. So it's important to note, like, even if they're not getting money directly from AIPAC, which most of them are, if not, I think there's probably like a handful that don't, they're getting money from some interest that at least has a small interest in continuing wars and stuff like that. But that's at the political class level. I meant at the like voter level, at the people level. I think Americans in general just have war exhaustion. I feel like there's a collective like sigh of relief when we finally get out of Afghanistan. Even though it was done like awfully, like we did it in the least effective way possible, if you ask me. But there was still that sigh of relief, like finally it's done. And then it was like the next day there was a war with Ukraine that we were like so heavily involved in and spending our money on. It was like, I know I took away Afghanistan, but here's a Ukraine war for you. Now we have the war in Israel too. I feel like there's just like, we didn't even have a chance to relax after Afghanistan. We just got right into the next thing. So I think that there's exhaustion from the people. Like if they try to say like, oh, we have to go to war, with Iran or something strategically, I don't think we would win anything there, but just politically, I don't think there's the will for it. That's why we see, with Yemen, we have our ships out there, but they're like, the strategy seems to be, and I think this was true even when I was in Iraq in like 2008, that the main goal of the United States is to be at war, but like in such a way that most Americans don't even realize that we're at war. Like when I got back, there's people like, oh, we're still there. Like, yeah, we're still there. And I think that's by design, right? They don't want Americans to realize we're at war because they want, then they'll protest against it. That people don't want that. So,
And according to Kamala Harris, we're not at war with anybody and we don't have any troops in combat zones.
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. All of our troops are safe and sound and in their homes, and it's crazy. That's kind of like the short, I know it sounds very long, but that's a short run of it. I got a ton of articles on it. If anybody's like interested in diving deep, you could check out the website there, diligent.news, and read about like the history of it, like how it impacts America, the munition stuff I talked about. There's a couple articles on that. Feel free to dig around there for more in-depth stuff on it.
We're almost at the top of the hour, but I want to hit on this as well today. The Pentagon, so been reports and confirmed reports that North Korea has sent troops into Russia to join the fight in Ukraine. And the Pentagon just released a statement that said, Pentagon warns that there'll be no limits on Ukraine support if North Korea actively joins the war. We said that the United States is warning it is ready to escalate NATO involvement in Ukraine if North Korea troops join in active fighting in Ukraine. the U.S. will not impose new limits on Ukraine's use of American weapons if North Korea joins the war. And Pentagon said Monday that, as NATO said, North Korean military units have been deployed in the Kursk region in Russia. So I know you'd said that Trump is trying to end the war in Ukraine, and you said he could do it pretty quick. I think it has to be done. I think it's just everyone that is dying needlessly. There's nothing to be gained in continuing this. But this seems like a very big escalation, and so I'd like to get your thoughts.
So I looked into this the other day because I saw it was on your notes, right? And the only thing I found that like said exactly where the North Korean troops were that wasn't from like Zelensky in Ukraine, there's a Reuters article, and it placed them in Vladivostok, which is 4,000 and roughly 4,200 miles away from Ukraine. They were in Far East Russia doing some training and stuff, was this Reuters article from 1023. So I don't know if there's like really any risk of them being over there, or if this is just, you know, more propaganda. My take on, I think we mentioned it before too, but like my take on the whole like North Korea in fighting Ukraine thing is that like not enough people are buying the Russia boogeyman story right now, so they're trying to find one that they will. So laughably, like to back that up too, you know, they were blaming, I think it was the Starmer, I think from the UK, was blaming the famine in Gaza on Russia. So they're trying to pin everything on Russia and like align Russia with like all these like, you know, boogeymen and bad guys, to try to build the case for like why we should still want to be in a war with Russia. So that's what I see this as. I don't think Russia needs North Koreans' help in Ukraine. I don't know their manpower numbers. Oh, so I couldn't speak to that, but I don't like just from a manufacturing standpoint, I mentioned like the munition stuff, right? Altogether, NATO is making like 1.2 million 155 shells a year. That's all of NATO, including the United States, versus Russia alone, which makes like 3 million 155 shells a year. Their manufacturing base is pretty strong, which makes me feel like the, you know, if their manufacturing is still pretty strong, they're probably doing okay in other areas. So I don't think that they need North Korean troops over there, and because they don't need them there, they're not going to send them there just because of the geopolitical like impact of it and stuff like that. So I think they're probably just out east training and stuff and showing that they're friends.
Well, I'm glad that I didn't read too far into that, so I do apologize, but I'm glad you cleared that up. And so it'll be just interesting still to monitor, but I think you hit the head pretty square in the nail there, or hit the nail pretty square with that, is that they're just trying to create a new boogeyman so that they continue their money laundering efforts in Ukraine. But we hit the top of the hour, so go ahead and start wrapping everything up. Does anybody on the panel have anything else they'd like to say? Any closing comments before I go ahead and finish up things?
I'll just say congratulations to everybody that's been stacking, whether it's 4 months, 4 years, or longer. We've outlasted the sideways and should be seeing some price discovery coming up. So congrats to all of you.
Yes, thank you, Bob. And I plan on going over later in the week, just talking about for people that are going to start finding us, because again, once it starts making significant gains and new all-time highs, we're going to just inevitably gather new listeners and new people coming into the space. And so I want to spend some time just going over the importance of knowing what you're doing. I don't consider Bitcoin investing, and so I wouldn't phrase it as that, but just make sure everyone kind of understands what they're getting into when they first get in, and the importance of self-custody, starting them right off the start. Not putting FUD, that holding your own keys is extremely complicated. Again, memorizing 12 or 24 words is very easy. There's nothing extremely technical about that. You just need to make sure that you understand what you're doing, but it's not difficult to hold your own keys. So I think Thursday or Friday we'll go over, I guess it's tomorrow, shoot. Tomorrow or Friday we'll go over this and talk about for everybody that's just starting to find us.
I can tell you, Coleman, just one more comment. I can tell you just with the, you know, the price where it's at, I've already received several inquiries, just people that had either started buying and want to learn about self-custody. In fact, while I was on this space, I had someone call me, and I know what they're calling me about. So I think it's coming. It's just a matter of time. And so for different people, it's going to be at different price points. It'll be when they see it on CNBC or when it's in the news and there's finally some positive news about it that gets released. But it's coming. So hopefully you guys have been planting seeds too with friends, family that'll pay attention and will reach out to you. But be prepared. You might get bombarded.
Yes. And I'm glad you're getting those phone calls. And so I hope everyone starts getting those. Remember, it's up to you on how you handle your own business, but be patient. Remember, everyone's just starting to learn. Remember the first time you heard Bitcoin, you most likely didn't take it seriously then either. I know if I could go back, I would slap the crap out of myself back in 2013 for just passing it off. But that's kind of how everybody is. So just again, patience and just direct them in the right direction. Steer them clear of Coinbase, Strike, River, Unchained. Those are the ones I always recommend. So please just have some patience and send them to us. Send them to the Bitcoin Veterans. There's no better space out there where they're gonna learn and they'll be accepted. So Bob, that's an awesome way to end this. I want to thank everybody who tuned in today. Wade on the Bitcoin Alaska handle, Lisa, AC, Eomar, Bob, of course, and Jacob doing everything on the back end, and everybody out there in the audience. It really means a lot that you guys and girls are consistently listening to us. Again, we're doing this every day, Monday through Friday at 10 a.m. Go back and click on the Bitcoin Veterans handle or check us out on our YouTube page. We did an update with Operation Gabriel last night with Shane and Mike. It was a great conversation. It was really eye-opening in case you haven't really been following along. And if you have been following along with what we've been doing, it was good to hear firsthand accounts of everything going on. So check us out at the Bitcoin Veteran handle on YouTube. And again, I want to thank everybody just for tuning in. But let's make sure as this price is ripping, let's spread this message of Bitcoin and what it can do and how it'll help the world and get people off this hamster wheel. So let's start planting more orange pills. So let's get out there and let's get on the mission. But do not shitcoin. It's like buying a lottery ticket with yesterday's numbers.